This is the Future of HR podcast, episode 132.
Yeah, I would say there's two things in the first 100 days or whatever. The first is a continuation of the discussion about capabilities within the function, which is really assessing, do you have the A team that you need? What changes do you need to make? And then secondly, really to assess honestly your relationships that are critical stakeholder relationships. What's the relationship with the CEO first and foremost? If you're from the outside, you're building a new relationship. If you're from the inside, you're now establishing yourself as a true advisor confidant to that CEO. But also the relationships with the board, because most of the time, new CHROs who haven't been a CHRO elsewhere haven't really had to build the relationships with the board. And so assessing what's the strength of those relationships, who do you know on the board, how well do you know them? And then I actually have my folks do an assessment of the executive leadership team and really honestly assess what's the strength of each relationship on that ELT, and then which ones matter the most. So if you're going to prioritize where you're going to make investments and nurture those relationships, which ones matter the most to your success?
How can you establish credibility and build key relationships in your first 90 days? What separates HR leaders who secure board seats from those who don't? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. Imagine having direct access to 18 world-class thought leaders who will elevate and transform how you think about HR. As many of you know, late last year, I launched Elevate, a three-week virtual development experience that over 100 HR leaders attended and participants described as a master's degree in HR at a fraction of the cost and by far the most engaging learning experience in years. Elevate 2025 returns on May 20th, and it's specifically designed to elevate HR business partners and Center of Excellence professionals, strategic capabilities, and business impact. Who will you learn from at Elevate? We're talking Dave Ulrich on the next agenda for HR, Muriel Wilkins on breaking through limiting beliefs, Mark Efron on connecting talent philosophy to business strategy, plus sessions on AI-driven process redesign, agile HR, top team effectiveness, operating model transformation, how to communicate like an executive, what your CEO actually wants from HR, and how to get your expertise actually used. Every session is designed with the goal of helping you to take your business acumen, strategic thinking, influence, and coaching capabilities to the next level. Also, the 16 interactive sessions include live Q&A, where your specific challenges and questions get addressed by the expert themselves. And with recorded sessions and slides available afterwards, you don't have to worry about missing a session, or even better, you and your team can revisit these insights again and again. Super early bird pricing ends this Thursday, March 20th, saving you $350 off the full price of Elevate. So register now at www.elevate2025.vip/nextgenhr or go to futureofhr.com to learn more. Don't miss this once a year chance to transform your capabilities and accelerate your career at Elevate 2025. And with that, I'm excited to introduce this week's guest, Marcia Avedon. Marcia is someone who truly understands what it takes to become a board-ready CHRO. Over her very impressive career, Marcia has been a CHRO for three Fortune 500 companies, and she has been serving as a board of director for over 20 years at various companies. This early and sustained board experience has given her a deep understanding of what it takes for a CHRO to earn a seat on a board. Marcia is also the founder of Avedon Advisory, where she brings her extensive experience to executives navigating complex challenges from talent strategy to large-scale transformations. And what makes Marcia's perspective so valuable is her unique blend of experiences across human resources, communication, marketing, and public affairs at the highest organizational levels. Her insights on connecting strategy, culture, and talent have made her a sought-after advisor, speaker, and thought leader. In addition, Marcia often coaches and works with new CHROs to help them transition into the role and maximize their impact as leaders. And not surprisingly, Marcia is a fellow of the National Academy for HR, the highest honor in our profession. This was a great conversation, and I know you'll enjoy it as Marcia and I discussed why great leaders spot potential in others before they see it in themselves, how the role of CHRO has evolved to be seen as a strategic business partner and valued board member, practical strategies for HR leaders to position themselves for board opportunities, why effective communication is the cornerstone of successful organizational transformation, and how new CHROs can establish credibility and build meaningful relationships in their first 90 days, and much, much more. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode as you listen, so drop me a line on LinkedIn or say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Marcia. Marcia, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
I am doing great, JP. Great to be with you.
Oh, it's great to have you and really excited to talk about your amazing corporate career, what you're doing now, the board work, how you're coaching CHROs. You just continue to do a lot, not only throughout your career, but kind of in this post-CHRO career. So let's jump into that. You have had this amazing career, as I talked about. You were CHRO for 18 years, first at Merck and then Trane Technologies. That's formerly Ingersoll Rand, if you remember those from those days. But kind of looking back over your career, tell us about a few of the key learnings on how to build and manage a career. How do you have an incredible career like you've had, Marcia?
Well, one thing that I reflect on and I share with others who ask similar questions is I think it's really important to get out of your comfort zone. And let me give an example of what that might look like for some people. Early in my career, I studied industrial organizational psychology. I was more of a specialist. I saw myself, I have a PhD in IO psychology. I saw myself as sort of the specialist expert in leadership development, organization development, and so on. And at one point during my Honeywell career, I was working on a big reorganization of the company, and the president of the division basically said, well, so what do you want to do when you're done with this big reorg? And I kind of said, I like what I'm doing, but my role was actually going to be one of the ones that was eliminated. I was just trusting something good would happen. And he said, well, I want you to go run HR for this division, which was the polymers division down in Richmond, Virginia, which meant relocating from New Jersey to Richmond. But it also meant from going from a corporate specialist, if you will, a COE, we would call it now, to a line division HR VP of a big global division with the largest unionized workforce, I think, in the company at the time. And they were the Teamsters. They were a difficult union. So it was really out of my comfort zone. But I'll tell you what, JP, now I look back, and that was a turning point in my career. And I think my two learnings about that were, one, it forced me to lead through others. My team knew a lot more about labor relations and dealing with the particulars of that business, and people around the globe knew about their countries and their issues in those particular markets. So I had to lead through others was the first key learning. But the other learning was that I loved being on a business leadership team, working cross-functionally with all the business leaders to help run the business, run the company. And it was this big aha for me that as much as I prided myself in being this great specialist expert person, I actually loved the breadth of being on a business leadership team. But if I had never gotten out of my comfort zone, I'd still be doing the same kinds of things that I was doing. And now this was many, many years ago. So I just use that example of often the greatest turning point in your career is something you're not sure you want to do, you're not comfortable with, but you take a chance. And I moved my family. I did a lot of things to take a chance, and it turned out really well for me.
Yeah, that's a great story. And something we've heard on the podcast, that theme of a leader sees something in you or has an opportunity for you that you're just not feeling like you're quite ready for, or it's not the right fit. And it turns out to be, you know, an amazing experience. And I think there's just something to be said for others can sometimes see things in ourselves that we can't see. And so I'm glad you shared that, Shauren.
Absolutely. And I often tell people as leaders that if you can be the one to tell someone what you see in them, it can change their whole outlook about their career and who they are. I remember the first time the former CHRO of, then it was Allied Signal before it was even Honeywell, when he told me I was on succession plan, long-term succession plan to be the CHRO, I was totally shocked. I had no idea. I went home and told my husband, I had the weirdest conversation today with Don. And he's like, well, why is that so weird, Marcia? It's like, well, I never thought of myself as running HR for a whole enterprise as a CHRO. I think I was in my 30s at the time. You know, I was young. I was in my late 30s. And I remember just because that wasn't in my psyche. My psyche, I was an expert in leadership and organization and all of that. But boy, I'll tell you, the combination of that breadth of experience with someone validating and seeing something in you in terms of your potential to lead was very instrumental.
Yeah, it's an important message that leaders can have such an impact when they share that kind of feedback on what they see in others, and it can really shape their worldview and maybe their future career like it did for you. You've also, over the course of your career, Marcia, and to this day, have been really involved in external organizations and really working to improve our field, build your network. For instance, you served on the board for the Center for Creative Leadership. You are on the executive director for the Center for Executive Succession. You're also a National Academy Fellow. How has building your network and being involved with these different organizations helped to shape your approach to HR, leadership, and just business overall?
I don't think I was intentional, honestly, JP, about that. It builds over time. I always enjoyed being involved in the broader community. Selfishly, I always learned. I would see these others that were before me who I admired, and I just wanted to learn from them. As you move up in HR, it becomes a little lonelier, right? There's a lot of things you can't talk to anyone about because they're so confidential. So for me, being part of professional associations, being part of external networks, was always a way for me to continue to grow and learn. And as a result, I did create a really amazing network, which still serves me well today, by the way. But I did it for my own learning, just to have people I could bounce things off of, and vice versa. I found that people reached out then to me and reciprocated. And sometimes on the most sensitive things, you mentioned the Center on Executive Succession. CEO succession is one of those things. CHROs really can't talk to anyone about that. A trusted peer in another company who's going through something similar is usually a safe way to get some feedback. Now, hopefully, people will join the center and get that support from the center. So I do think it was extremely beneficial to me in ways I could never even anticipate. And I will share with you, in the 2.5 years I've been out of the C-suite, all of my consulting and coaching, all of it, not a single one of my engagements came from someone I knew. So there's not one engagement that I've had where I've like marketed or done anything. People reached out to me because they had worked with me in some other capacities. It's really super important. You can't do everything, so you have to pick a few things and be really engaged. One of the things I also suggest to people I'm coaching or advising is, if you commit to being part of an organization, you really have to contribute and really participate. And I think that's one of the reasons my network thrived, is I was someone who not only just had my name listed, but I actually served on committees and did things and took leadership positions and made an impact. Like on HR Policy Association, I was on the executive committee. I was at one point the chair of the Center on Executive Compensation. And I, you know, when they needed someone to do stuff, I would raise my hand and do stuff. So I think it's not only signing on and listening, but also really actively participating, being on panels and giving of yourself and your time. I think that's what really makes the difference and where you really engage with others.
Yeah, I think you sometimes have to give before you get, right? And you've got to put something into these programs, into these networks and these organizations to really get the most out of it. But I do wonder, Marcia, if you're thinking about next gen HR leader, maybe in an early to mid career, what advice do you have for them in terms of building their network? Where should they start?
There's lots of ways to do that. I was just coaching a CHRO, which I know is a different audience than you're asking about, but she shared with me she was at the Gartner conference last week, and I was shocked to hear there were 6,000 people there, which I had no idea they had that kind of a participation. So good for Gartner. But I thought to myself, what an incredible place to network, right? But when you go to something that big, you have to be very intentional of what sessions you go to, who you want to be with, et cetera. I really like when associations have activities that are maybe smaller groups, and you can then really talk to people in a little bit more of a intimate way about whatever subjects you're most interested in. So I think going to conferences, going to events, looking for smaller communities in some sense. There are tons of these networks now. I was at one point one of the founding members of HR 50, for example. That was nice because they were relatively small group meeting. I mean, not really small, but not thousands of people. They you'd have between 30 and 50 people at a meeting. So that was really good. But I do think getting that outside in perspective and getting out and going to a couple things a year, then if there's a network where you can dial in to lunchtime calls or those sorts of things, those would be some of my suggestions.
Great suggestions. Let's talk a little about CHROs on boards. According to a recent report by Equilar, the percentage of directors at Russell 3000 companies with CHRO experience increased from 0.09% in 2022 to 1.1% in 2023. That is a 22% increase, but gosh, that still feels pretty darn low to me. Yet, Marcia, you have been on boards for most of your CHRO career. You now sit on two public boards, one private equity-backed board. This really makes you an innovator in my mind. You have a lot of experience around not only what boards want from a potential board member who also happens to have CHRO experience. So with that in mind, just talk about some of the misconceptions of what does a board do? What do they want from HR leaders in general? And how do you get on a board?
Yeah, I get asked that a lot because I was, I guess, one of the forerunners of CHROs on boards. Before this call, prepping for this podcast, I had to look back. My first public company board, not nonprofit boards, but public company board was Lincoln Financial. And it was in 2005 that I got on that board. So it's really almost 20 years ago, which is really, I probably was one of the few at that time who were CHROs on boards. I feel fortunate because one of the things I've learned is it's the hardest is to get the first one. So if you're not a CEO or a CFO, everyone else getting the first one is the hardest. I was naive and had no idea about that. The CHRO of Merck at the time, newly appointed the CHRO of Merck, so quite inexperienced even in the C-suite, let alone as a board member. And I had an opportunity through a search firm for one board, and I didn't get that. But one of the people I interviewed with liked me a lot, and he was the CEO, and he said, but I'd like to have you on my board. And he was John Basha, who was the then CEO of Lincoln Financial. And I said, John, I know nothing about financial services. I've been in consumer products and industrial companies. I don't know anything about insurance. Why do you want me on your board? And he said, because my company will thrive because of human capital and human behavior and the way we function. And I need someone like you. And he was very into the talent strategy of the company. I said, well, I can bring you that. I said, and then I'll have to learn your business. So that was my first board experience. It was actually quite short-lived, interestingly, because they merged the company. And it was like the last one in, first one out. And so there were several of us when they combined the two boards who stepped up, including myself. But because I had had those couple years, I got more calls over the years after that. In terms of your question about what do boards need and expect and what misconceptions are there, I think that people often forget first that the board is not management. So it's a shift going from a C-suite executive to being a director. You are not managing the company, first and foremost. Secondly, there's really two roles, and sometimes people think of one or they think of the other. So the one is the fiduciary governance role of a director, right? You are really serving on behalf of the shareholders, and you're upholding all the governance and fiduciary responsibilities of, particularly with public companies, of the requirements of the shareholders and regulatory bodies. But the second, and I would say equally important, is the advisory part of being a great director, which plays into why do boards now want CHROs, right? And hopefully the board is not just wanting you because you're going to chair the Compensation and Human Capital Committee or whatever they're calling it. Hopefully they're seeing you as an advisor to that CEO and executive team on a whole host of matters. I think to get on a board, you need to think about what is it that you bring to a particular board and what do you bring in general to the boardroom? And it's more than just your HR expertise. Again, back to the beginning of the podcast, when I talked about becoming a broad business person. You know, in my case, the board calls that I get are because I've had M&A experience, a lot of M&A experience and divestitures and spinoffs. Because I'm a global executive, because I've done major transformations, and because I'm an HR executive who can chair the comp committee. They do like that. And usually, although I would say of my three boards right now, I'm only chairing one of them. The other one I'm sort of in line to chair. So again, the point is that you're coming onto a board as a well-rounded business person, a strategist, with a lot of different skills, not just your HR skills. And then the second thing I learned, it was unusual, let me just say, with LinkedIn, my first one, because what I've learned in the last 20 years is that industry does matter. And to get on a board, it's much harder to get on a board of a company in an industry that you've never worked. So most of my other board experiences have been in industries that were somehow similar to or related to the industries that I worked in full time. So for example, I'm on the board of Generac Power Systems, which makes generators, both home standby as well as commercial and industrial generators, and also does things related to clean energy and energy technology. Well, you can see my Trane Technologies experience with other global companies that supply both equipment and digital solutions for the built environment is very analogous, right? So you could see why I was attractive and they wanted me to chair the comp committee and help the CHRO and so on. So I say then, think about your own portfolio skills and what's relevant to a board beyond just HR. Think about the industries that you really know and can contribute strategically. And then the last advice I'd have related to getting on boards is your board bio cannot be your resume or your CV. A board bio is typically a one-page narrative, typically, that tells the story of your experiences that are relevant to being on a board. So it's not your whole chronology of everything you've done in your career. Being really thoughtful of tying those skills, those relevant skills, into your board bio, making sure that's your sales pitch to why you should be a director.
Wow, really, really thorough answer. I'm curious in kind of two points. How have you seen the perception of CHROs change in that time? I mean, 2005 feels like a long time ago, but have you seen the CHRO role evolve and change over that time period?
I've seen the CHRO role change a great deal, and I've seen the degree to which boards value CHROs on boards tremendously. I know your data from Equilar was through last year, 23. I suspect when the 24 data comes out, it'll be even higher. And I think the reason that boards want CHROs. There's multiple reasons. But one is the role of the CHRO is now a really critical business role on the leadership team. Certainly in the early 2000s and before that, there were some companies where CHROs were really leading and driving business performance in the people side of the business. But there were a lot that were still doing more administrative and more tactical kinds of things. And I think as the HR roles have become more sophisticated, more strategic, their value then to be on boards also is increasing.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I do hope the data is going to be higher. It's also, I will just acknowledge, it's hard to find this data. So if anybody has better data than what I've seen, I'd appreciate it. But it's typically not broken out. That is what makes it also really challenging because I feel like it just feels low to me in general. I continue to see more CHROs get on boards, but that's probably a recency bias effect. One last question around boards, and then we'll move on to some other subjects, Marcia. I just think for a CHRO that really aspires to get on a board, that's a current CHRO today, how do you think they should be thinking about getting themselves positioned? Is it partly the network? Are there certain recruiters that do these roles? Great feedback on the board bio, but is there anything else they should be doing to build a brand that would really get them ready to have that reputation to be on a board?
Well, I think that there are, to answer your first question, there are recruiters that specialize in positions at the board level. A lot of them do board search and CEO search or board search and something else, but there are also some that just do board search. And I often give those names to my friends who are looking to get on a board. I also think that just letting it be known that you're looking for a board position, that may sound very basic, but for example, if you're a CHRO of a current publicly traded company, talk to your current board members of your company. And they're often on other boards. They have a lot of relationships and they can often be very helpful. Just getting your name out there, they're not going to get you on a board, but they're going to get your name out there. They may get calls. Talk to your other peers who are CHROs who are already on boards. I get a lot of those calls and I've actually reviewed people's board bios and given them feedback and they're usually way too detailed and not as punchy as they need to be. And making it very clear, what kinds of companies do you think you would be a great director? One person that I was having that conversation with just got on her first board. And it was broadly in the industry that she spent most of her time in. And I think that originally it was she was looking everywhere, right? And she was so knowledgeable in that industry. Why not play to that strength? And then she ended up getting her first board. So thinking strategically about where you'll play best, where you'll have the biggest impact. And I will share with you on the Lincoln example. That first year was really hard. It was like you're in a foreign country speaking a different language. A lot of the terminology and so forth was so different. When I've gotten on industrial company boards, GCP or other ones that I've been on, I felt very comfortable because the conversations were the same ones we were having in our boardroom or in our executive team meetings. I would just underscore it, at least for your first one, go closer in. However, it can't be a conflict. If you're in an executive position as a CHRO or other executive position, it can't be a conflict. What does that mean? You can't do business with them above a certain threshold and vice versa, right? So you have to be independent. So you can't have any interlocking relationships. So there's usually a scan by the general counsels to make sure that's the case. But it's kind of a double-edged sword. You want to know enough, but not so much that they're a competitor or supplier, et cetera.
So much good advice there and really helpful. And I think that industry experience, while HR is really transferable, and I think that CHROs can move industries and learn, there's a time you can learn. But I think a board, to your point, people are expecting you to hit that ground running. There's deep expertise and you're trying to give advice that I think having that industry experience would make you just so much more effective then. So I imagine that was pretty tough that first year at Lincoln Financial coming from your background. But Marcia, you also talked a lot about you have done a lot of mergers, acquisitions, transformation work. And so I wanted to talk to you about your experience with large scale change. In your experience, where can HR create the most value during these major transformations? What have you seen really work?
Yeah. So I will say it's, to me, one of the most fun parts of being a CHRO or even an HR leader at a different level when you get those opportunities, because that word transformation gets thrown around so much. But what do we mean by that? When you're doing a large reorganization, or in my case, we spun off a company as a publicly traded company, or we created two companies from one through something called reverse Morris Trust. So those really big changes create a lot of opportunity. One of the things that was really terrific for me at Ingersoll Rand and Trane Technologies is I had not only HR responsibilities, but I had communications and public affairs as well. Because I think whether you are only in the HR function or not, the communications aspects of large-scale change just can't be underestimated. And all the stakeholders that are impacted, we often think, of course, of the employees. But when you're doing really large-scale change, you have to think of all the stakeholders, the customers, the suppliers, the investment community, et cetera. So my first piece of advice is make sure your communications partners are part of your team from the beginning. And they're thinking about the messaging, because you may do the greatest change, but if people don't understand it, they don't understand why, or they're confused, or there's ambiguity, the success of that change won't be as effective. For example, major, major change like M&A or spinoffs, we'll often hire a third-party firm to supplement the internal communications people. So we'll hire a PR firm and bring them under confidentiality, and they'll help make sure we're managing the external messages, particularly for investors, so that you get the positive reaction from your investment community or shareholders. When we created Trane Technologies and the new Ingersoll Rand, which Ingersoll Rand now is a merger between the industrial part of Ingersoll Rand with what used to be Gardner Denver Company. So we were at the same time merging two companies and creating a new climate control company called Trane Technologies. You can imagine we were trying to stand up two stocks, essentially, all on the same day. By the way, it was March 1st of 2020. So it was right as we realized we're in a pandemic. Talk about crazy. It was crazy. But I will tell you, without our PR partners, and by the way, both companies, if you look at TT and IR stock on the stock exchange, and you look from 2020 to today, both of them have crazily outperformed. So how you know that these change efforts are successful when they're that big, your shareholders tell you, right? But what was really cool about the Trane Technologies side, which was the, I'll call it RemainCo of the split, was we said, let's reimagine what this company could be. Trane was a well-known company for 100 years for HVAC. But if we were in a digital world, we were talking about building automation, sustainability, all these ideas. And we wanted the new brand of the company to stand for more than this, what was known as an orange meatball, which is when you look on your Trane HVAC, there's that logo. We wanted it to stand up as a new company. So we said we were a 100-year-old startup. We reinvented the purpose, the mission, the name of the company. The words Trane Technologies as the parent company was very intentional. New logo, new color, new everything. And so we did not let only the merged companies get a day one, but we made sure the RemainCo of Trane Technologies had this amazing day one. And we did events all around the world. So we engaged people. We managed the communications. The word intentionality is the word I would use most, JP, about when you're doing large-scale change, you don't want to leave anything to chance. You want to be very intentional about what are people going to think? What are they going to feel? What are they going to see? And what are they going to do that's different than in the past, right? We had an amazing team of people from marketing, communications, HR, the leadership team. We had leaders all over the world having events at the same time. When we said we were a startup, we wanted it to feel different. So even the way we used to do town halls in a typical huge hall with all these rows of chairs and the leaders at the front, we're like, let's make it way more fun. And so they were like, they were just fun. People were standing up. They were cheering. There were people going around with mics all through. It was almost like you're in Times Square on New Year's Eve. It didn't feel like our stuffy traditional town hall. You say transformation, and often it's drawing the lines in the boxes in different ways, and it's a restructure. If it's transformation, it should feel different. It should feel different to anyone who's touched by the change. So those are a couple illustrations that hopefully bring it to life a little bit.
Yeah, really great examples. And I love how you're just kind of underlining and focusing on that transformation. It's got to feel different. And that you guys really thought through, like, what does it mean to be a startup and start the culture and question everything and do things differently in a way that gets that energy going. And I think that not only requires a lot of leadership from the HR team, but the leadership team as well to do that and understand that that's what's going to make it successful. So I really, really appreciate that example, Marcia. Speaking of transformation, you also work with a lot of CHROs, current and aspiring, and coaching them, helping them to be even more effective and continue to enhance themselves as leaders. I'm wondering if you could talk about some of the common challenges you see CHROs facing and how you help advise them overcome some of those challenges.
Sure, JP. It's actually one of the things I've been enjoying most in my 2.0 or next chapter of my career. I've had the really good fortune of coaching a number of amazing people who are current or newly promoted CHROs and a couple who were aspiring. There are some common themes that I think when I look across, each one is a sort of bespoke engagement, but there are commonalities. The first one is, in each case, the CHRO is thinking about how does their HR strategy really enable the business strategy? How are they linked? How are they integrated? The specifics differ, but in all the cases, we've spent a lot of time with them thinking about it, but also getting input from the CEO, from business leaders, and bringing their team together to really recreate the strategy in a more impactful way. Usually a prong of that strategy is about sort of HR transformation or HR excellence, functional excellence, and do they have the right team and operating procedures to deliver on the strategy? So those are a couple of the common themes that I see across CHROs and organizations.
Yeah, that's really important. I mean, number one, obviously, we've got to be really aligned as HR leaders with the business strategy. That's what we're here to do. But then I think the piece that I'd like you bringing up is sort of, okay, well, how do we make HR as excellent as possible? Do we have the capabilities to deliver what the business needs as well? And how do we continue to invest? And that's an area that obviously I'm really passionate about as well. And it's challenging at times, right? You've got to really look at that and figure out what do we need, depending on what that situation is, that organization. Do you, Marcia, thinking about like a new CHRO and that transition period, first 90 days to 6 months, are there a few things you say you really have to do to land well with that new executive team and CEO?
Yeah, I would say there's two things in the first 100 days or whatever. The first is a continuation of the discussion about capabilities within the function, which is really assessing, do you have the A team that you need? What changes do you need to make? And then secondly, really to assess honestly your relationships that are critical stakeholder relationships. What's the relationship with the CEO first and foremost? If you're from the outside, you're building a new relationship. If you're from the inside, you're now establishing yourself as a true advisor confidant to that CEO. But also the relationships with the board, because most of the time, new CHROs who haven't been a CHRO elsewhere haven't really had to build the relationships with the board. And so assessing what's the strength of those relationships, who do you know on the board, how well do you know them? Of course, the compensation committee chair is a critical player, but usually either the board chair or the lead director is a critical relationship. And then I actually have my folks do an assessment of the executive leadership team and really honestly assess what's the strength of each relationship on that ELT and then which ones matter the most. So if you're going to prioritize where you're going to make investments and nurture those relationships, which ones matter the most to your success? Very deliberately, we kind of go through that. I normally do a 360 too, so I get not only their own view, but I get others' views as well. And they take all that. And in the first 90 days, they have a plan about how are they going to build those relationships, both at the board level with the executive team and or with their own team. I have one case where the person was promoted from within. They were all her peers, and some of them were not happy about her getting the job. And so in 90 days, you have to realize, are they going to get over it and get on board or not, right? So all of those relationship kinds of things, I think, are really critical in the first 100 days. In another case, I was coaching someone who was interim, and the CEO really liked her, wanted her, but he was new. And so the board was like, well, maybe you need to go out and get a more experienced CHRO. We'll see how she does for a few months while you're searching, right? And so the goal was to influence the board, get enough at-bats, I call it, you know, using a sports analogy, enough at-bats that the board can say, oh, wow, she is really talented. She's really bright. Maybe she can do the job. Each situation's a little bit different in terms of who you're trying to influence and build credibility and all of that. But it's all about relationships and credibility in those first 90-100 days.
Really, really helpful. One more question around this topic. There are a lot of next-gen HR leaders that listen to the podcast who might aspire to become CHROs. What are one, two, or three, maybe, max, pieces of advice you have for them on how do you get to prepare yourself to be a CHRO?
Well, tying back to my earlier career experience, I do think you need breadth. So if you've primarily been a business partner, a generalist, and you've never been in a corporate COE function, you probably need some of both. Or the reverse, if you were like me and you were more of a specialist, you need to get out, as the CEO said to me, get dirt under your fingernails and get out of corporate. So getting that breadth of experience, I think, again, would be my first piece of advice, so that you're well-rounded as an HR professional in the fullest sense of that. I also think my second piece of advice is raise your hand. What do I mean by that? If there's something big, strategic, important going on in the company, you need to raise your hand and say, put me in, coach, right? I remember way back in my Honeywell days when we were doing the Allied Signal Honeywell merger, mega merger. I was in that division role I talked about, but they were forming all these integration teams. And I raised my hand. I said, I want to lead one. I want to be involved, even though my division actually wasn't integrating very much with the other side. So I was put in to lead the compensation integration work streams for the whole company. You learn a lot, you get visibility, you sort of get a taste of what are the issues at an enterprise-wide level. So breadth of experience in terms of roles, raise your hand would be the second thing I would say. Do things outside of your direct responsibilities, right? Be willing to pitch in and do big, important things. I remember my successor at Trane Technologies. First thing I did is I got her out of the business partner roles, which, kicking and screaming, she didn't want to do it. But I had her lead talent for the company, and she'd not been in a corporate role. She would tell you today those 3.5-4 years leading talent were the most developmental to be a CHRO. She got board exposure. She got involved with succession planning at the highest levels of the company. She helped with a really big reorganization of the company. She was sort of my lieutenant, my number two on a lot of these big initiatives. So if you can get some or all of that experience that are, I'll call it parts of the CHRO role, but you need some enterprise-wide exposure and experience. So breadth of experience, raise your hand, and try to get enterprise-wide views any way you can.
Love it. Great advice. Last question for you, Marcia. What is one word or phrase that you believe define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
Agility. Agility comes to my mind because so much is changing in the world. I mean, everyone's talking about AI and digital and all of that. But I can't even believe in the last 4 or 5 years how much has changed. Where people work, how people work, the technologies people use. I think for HR, if we're going to be change leaders, if we're going to be advisors, if we're going to really impact the human side of business, we have to be agile. We have to be able to be a step ahead, thinking about things that haven't been thought of before and respond accordingly. So agility, I think, is going to be the key.
I agree, Marcia. Marcia, this has been an incredible conversation. Obviously, no wonder you have such an amazing reputation. I've done so well. I think we all learned a lot from this podcast and our conversation. Thank you so much for being on The Future of HR.
My pleasure, JP. Bye, everyone.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR podcast. Thanks again to Marcia for sharing her insights and experience on what it takes to become a board-ready CHRO. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. We'll be back next week with Muriel Wilkins. Muriel is the CEO and founder of Parvis Partners, and she's a sought-after C-suite advisor and executive coach. She's also the co-author of Own the Room, Discover Your Signature Voice to Master Your Leadership Presence, and her forthcoming book, Leadership Unblocked, Breakthrough Beliefs That Limit Your Potential, delves into overcoming internal barriers to unlock leadership success. Muriel is also the host of the award-winning Harvard Business Review podcast, Coaching Real Leaders. I learned so much from my conversation with Muriel, and you will not want to miss this one. Thanks again for listening to The Future of HR and being part of our community.